All right, so we do want to return to Romans. We have been working our way through the book of Romans. We're most of the way through it now. We are in Romans chapter 12. This is message number 60 in our series through Romans entitled Love in Work Clothes. Romans chapter 12, we'll be looking at verses 9 to 13. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing instant in prayer, distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality. Now, Paul opened this section, this last major section of the letter to the Romans, in verses 1 and 2 of this chapter, writing that the renewing or the renovating of our minds is required in order for us to be transformed, to live daily as sacrifices to God. And in the first paragraph of practical instruction, verses 3 to 8 that we looked at last time, Paul speaks immediately to the unity of the local church body with a diversity of gifts. Now, humility is necessary to cultivating such unity, and he started out there by saying not to think of ourselves more highly than we ought to think. So humility is necessary to cultivate that unity, and true humility is a product of a renewed mind and of a transformed life. Now, Paul didn't give us an exhaustive list of gifts in this particular paragraph, but rather he gave us a sample list that's diverse enough to make his point. Now, the church at Corinth was enriched with abundant and diverse gifts from the Spirit. And Paul talks about that at the very start of that letter in chapter 1, verses 4 to 7. But that had led to divisions and schisms in the body in Corinth, where there was competition, strife, jealousy, and boasting. So in a sense, Paul says, you come behind no other church. In other words, they were as abundantly blessed with a diversity of gifts within that body as any other church in the New Testament. And yet there were schisms within that body, divisions. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul speaks about the gifts in a very similar, though a more extensive way, than he does here in Romans 12. What he says there is that all the gifts have the same one source. So in other words, the gifts that are given by God, given by His Spirit, are not in conflict with one another. They're not in competition with one another. The gifts that are given are given. They're just that. They're gifts of grace. So it's not any merit within us. It's not anything that that we have done or they have done. And also, they are different. The gifts differ. And they're different by God's design in order to function together in harmony for the good of the whole body and to most glorify God. And that's what Paul said of the gifts in 1 Corinthians chapter number 12. And he's speaking very similarly here in Romans chapter number 12. Now, the discussion of gifts in the local church body in 1 Corinthians 12 is followed by what is sometimes referred to as the great love chapter in 1 Corinthians 13. And Paul follows this paragraph on gifts here in Romans chapter 12 with a love theme beginning in verse number 9. Now, again, in 1 Corinthians, it's much more extensive, but we can obviously see that there's a lot of parallels between those passages and this passage here. Verses 9 to 13 form a paragraph that is of a drastically different style from what we have read in Romans chapters 1 through 11. In these five verses, there are 13 commands given in brief, rapid statements. You'll notice there are no connecting words like for or therefore or for this reason or anything like that. So in other words, there's no extensive logical development here like what we have witnessed through so much of the first 11 chapters. But we must not forget that this section does start with a therefore back in verse number 1. And so all of the mercies of God in Christ from chapters 1 through 11 are behind and underneath every one of these commands. They're not detached from all of that rich theology that Paul has given us. They are in fact built on it. They flow from it. Now, reading these verses can appear to be random, disconnected thoughts. And just looking at them reminds me of sometimes reading in the book of Proverbs, where you have wisdom sayings that just come verse after verse after verse, and there isn't really any unifying theme or any sort of development or anything like that. It just seems to be almost randomly connected. But Paul is obviously continuing this general theme of unity. And just as humility is necessary to unity, so is love necessary to a God-glorifying unity. So like 1 Corinthians 13, brotherly love in the local church body is in view. And that is obvious from the one another statements that we see in this passage. Verses 9 to 13 also continue to show the transformed life produced by the renewed mind. Now, it would be easy to simply read these verses as a list of rules, and they can be read in just a matter of seconds and deal with behavior and behavior modification. But these commands don't just address behaviors, but they address mindsets. Paul is still talking here about the renewing of our minds. And for our mindsets to be changed, we need to give them more than just a few seconds of our time. Actually, as I said, there are 13 commands here, and quite honestly, we could spend a whole sermon on each one of them, and that would probably be a profitable thing to do. But nevertheless, we're going to look at this paragraph here this morning, verses 9 to 13, where Paul tells us to love one another. Verse 9, let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. Now, without dissimulation means without hypocrisy. If we would state that in sort of a positive way, we would say sincere or genuine. Let love be genuine. Let love be sincere. Let love be without hypocrisy. We might also just simply say, let love be real. This statement, it is akin to what John wrote in 1 John 3:18, where he wrote, my little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And John is talking there about the fact that love corresponds to both our words and our actions. And he is in essence saying, let them be the same. Don't let them be one or the other. Let them be the same. Well, this agape love that Paul is writing of here in verse number 9, it is a love internally that does involve our emotions and our wills. It's also a love externally that involves our words and our actions. Where we have a mismatch in these, is where we have hypocrisy or insincerity in our love. Where, in other words, where our wills and our emotions don't line up with our actions and our words in love, we have hypocrisy. We have love that is not sincere. We have love that is not genuine. Now, the second command that Paul issues, abhor that which is evil. Abhor is a very strong word and a word that is opposite to love. The word means to hate, to utterly detest. We might say that it is a command that amounts to saying reject that which is evil. The renewed mind, as Paul has told us at the beginning of this chapter, discerns what is evil. And here he is telling us to reject it. The third command also uses a strong word, cleave to that which is good. To cleave or to cling means to join together or even to be glued together. It's a word that can refer to the intimate closeness of a man and a woman in marriage, though marriage is not in view here at all. So also the renewed mind discerns what is good and is inseparably joined to it, clings to it. Now what Paul says about good and evil here is noteworthy. Good and evil, you'll notice, are objective realities. In other words, Paul doesn't tell us to obey our likes and dislikes. He doesn't tell us to hold to those things that are our preferences and to reject those things that we might find repulsive. There's no subjectivity here at all to this discernment or this judgment. He's certainly not telling us that we are to follow the shifting cultural definitions of what is good and what is evil. He's already told us in chapter 1, verses 18 to 32, that a sin-born, sin-loving, and sin-saturated culture gets good and evil completely upside down. And that, of course, is where we most assuredly are in our culture today. Good and evil are turned on their heads. So Paul is not telling us to lick the finger and stick it up and to see which way the wind is blowing. What is it that the world finds to be evil? What is it that the world finds to be good? And seek that out and cling to that good and abhor that evil. No, Paul says, abhor that which is evil and cleave to that which is good. In other words, God has told us what is good. God has told us what is evil. And we need renewed minds to discern between good and evil in accordance with God's judgment in His Word. That is what Paul is telling us to do. Further, Paul tells us that genuine love hates evil. Genuine love clings to good. Genuine love will not embrace evil, and genuine love will not abandon what is good. Verse number 10. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. Now, Paul twice uses the term one another in this verse. And he's showing us, again, this context for the genuine love that he's describing is particularly within that local church body. In other words, Paul's commands to love were not hypothetical. Paul wasn't thinking of what they were to do if they just happened to bump into another Christian somewhere at some time in some place. No, Paul's commands are very concrete. He is saying to one another, and as he's writing to the Romans, he means those that are among you. In other words, when you look around, those that are with you, those that are joined together. He had just previously written that they were different members in one body in Christ, and that they were members one of another. Those that you see face to face, those that you talk with face to face, those that you live with, that you worship with, and so on. Love one another. So again, this is not hypothetical. This is not something that's theoretical. This is not something that says, just suppose you happen to run into a fellow believer somewhere, here's what you should do. Remember that Paul is concerned that they together with one mind and one mouth glorify God. That's in chapter 15 and verse number 6. And that really is the theme. That is the purpose. That's what Paul is driving at in this whole section. So the words for kindly affectioned and brotherly love, both, they are different words, but both words relate to family love and affection. Both of them have philos in the words. Now, these words certainly were used outside of a blood relation context, but Paul is here viewing the members of a local church body as a kind of family. That's why that we have terms like brothers and sisters that we see used in the New Testament. And it's not like it was in Israel that we are all descendants of Abraham, but we are brothers and sisters because we have been joined to Christ by faith and have come together in a local body and have become members one of another, which is what he says to the Roman Christians. So then he gets to the last command of this verse, in honor, preferring one another. The last command in this verse calls the Roman Christians to show deference in honoring one another. Now, it was customary to show honor or to show deference to those of high social rank. And as you study life in the Roman Empire, you realize that there was very much a social hierarchy. And while it was possible for a person to rise within that social hierarchy, it was difficult. We might even say it was somewhat rare. And there was always a cap. There was always a ceiling that you weren't going to get past. And as you study the banquets and the feasts and the various things of the time, and you begin to realize how that those very meals upheld and reinforced the social hierarchy that existed in the Greco-Roman world, you realize how actually countercultural things like what Paul is talking about here really were. So yes, it was customary for honor to be shown to someone considered to be a dignitary. They may have some sort of governmental position or authority, or they may very well be from some noble family. They may very well be some very wealthy person. It was customary to show them honor. It was customary to show deference to those that were of a higher social rank. But here, Paul does not tell them to observe Greco-Roman social hierarchies. Paul says that they are to show honor to one another. And the force of the statement is for them to outdo each other in showing honor to one another. In other words, this is entirely apart from any sort of social standing. It's not telling them to honor the higher social class of the body there in Rome. He's telling them to honor one another. And that's whether someone is of a high class, of a low class, of a middle class, whatever that the case may be. Honor one another. Show deference to one another. And in fact, outdo one another in showing that sort of honor. Verse number 11. Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Now, the word for business means speed or haste, and it relates to eagerness or enthusiasm. And in fact, it can certainly reflect that, and I believe it does here in this verse. And the command that Paul is giving here is not to be lazy in eagerness. Contextually, he's referring to our service to God as living sacrifices. I mean, everything that Paul writes about in this section is connected to that opening admonition. So Paul is saying, don't be lazy in your eagerness or in your enthusiasm to live as sacrifices to God. Don't let it, in other words, don't let it slide. Or we might say, don't merely drift along in presenting your bodies as a living sacrifice in humility and genuine love, striving for unity for the glory of God. Don't be slothful about that. Don't be lazy about that. Don't, we might even say, don't be half-hearted about that. And that would be reinforced by the next statement where he says, fervent in spirit. That's providing us a contrast. Don't be slothful in business, but fervent in spirit. Now, the word for fervent literally means to be hot or even to boil. And figuratively, it is a word that often is used to speak of zeal. And there's a group of words that refer to that. These commands do provide us a contrast. The alternative that Paul is saying, rather than being lazy in our enthusiasm for God's service, he says, be fervent in spirit. Be zealous in spirit. Be ardent in spirit. These commands contrast once again what could be referred to as a slothful mindset, a lazy mindset, to what could be described as a fervent or a zealous mindset in the service of God. And then he says, serving the Lord. Serving the Lord, not softly, but fervently, serving the Lord. Now, the word for serving, it does mean to serve as a slave, and it does come from the Greek word doulos, which means a bond slave, and typically that is the meaning of the word when it is used. Serving the Lord, serving as a slave. Serving the Lord defines and it constrains the enthusiasm and the zeal that he has just commanded. If you remember, Paul had earlier reproved those Jews who had a zeal that wasn't according to knowledge. In chapter 10 and verse number 2, they had a zeal, which he commended the fact that they did have a zeal, but that zeal wasn't properly constrained or defined. It wasn't properly directed or focused. And so here Paul would have us not to be lazy about our enthusiasm for God's service, but to be zealous, and not just zealous for zeal's sake, but zealous in the service of the Lord, presenting our bodies as living sacrifices, not being conformed to the world, being transformed by the renewing of our minds. Verse number 12, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing instant in prayer. Well, it's interesting to me that this verse, these three commands that he gives here, these statements, reflect very much what Paul wrote of in chapters 5 to 8. This rejoicing in hope, very similar as Paul starting chapter number 5, that those who have been justified by faith in Jesus Christ have hope of the glory of God. And chapters 5 to 8 just unfold that glory in all of its wonder, that future glory that is inheritance of the saints. And Paul exhorts here to rejoice, to be glad, to be cheerful in that hope. Now, in those chapters, he argued extensively for the assurance of that hope for all those who believe in Jesus Christ. That hope is an ever-present joy in this present life that is filled with its tribulations. Paul also wrote of those tribulations in those chapters as well. And here he says, patient in tribulation. The word for patience means to endure or to stay under, as staying under a burden. Tribulations refers obviously to the pressures and the afflictions that come in this life. And as you recall, what Paul wrote about those tribulations in chapter 5 is that they are actually working good in us. In other words, the experience of enduring and bearing up under those tribulations is actually working good for us. And as you get to the end of chapter 8, he shows us that those tribulations in no way separate us from the love of Christ. So we are to be patient, to be enduring. And further, he admonishes continuing instant in prayer. He admonishes us to persevere in prayer, to keep on in prayer. Well, hope is a future hope, meaning that there are presently tribulations and groanings. Of course, Paul wrote about those in chapter 8 as well. And he's telling us that Christians must not give up or leave off praying. So rejoicing in hope, enduring afflictions, and persevering in prayer contribute to the renewing of our minds and the transforming of our lives. And then we come to verse number 13. Distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality. Genuine love and brotherly love now show up for us in work clothes. Distributing means sharing, being a partaker with, and here it is defined as sharing in the necessities or the needs or the lacks of the saints. Now, at the opening of this letter, Paul addressed all those in Rome who were in Christ as saints, chapter 1 and verse number 7. In other words, as you study in the New Testament, and this use of the term hagios, it doesn't refer to particularly saintly people or particularly pious people or someone that someone decides to canonize or whatever the case may be. Saints is one of the terms that is actually equivalent to the hasidim that we have seen in Psalms so often, which refers to those who are faithfully in covenant with God. It's believers in Jesus Christ. It's Christians. Saints, Holy ones is one of those terms that is used. So when he says the distributing to the necessity of saints, that's not limited among the body, but is defined by their needs. And then he says, given to hospitality. Hospitality literally means entertaining strangers or love to strangers. Hospitality typically referred to hospitality being shown to travelers. But it could more generally refer to meeting the life needs of others. And hospitality oftentimes comes down to those sort of things, food and drink and a place to sleep and all of those, just those needs of life being supplied. And notice that Paul uses this word given to hospitality. In other words, that word means to pursue, to go after hospitality. In other words, Paul is admonishing here that genuine love seeks out opportunities to show love, to give help, to meet the needs of others, and particularly of those members of the same body. Now, we certainly conclude from this passage that genuine love has tangible actions. Just like James wrote in his letter, it's not about mere well wishes, be ye warmed and filled, but yet never giving those in need the things that they need. No, genuine love has tangible actions. Renewed minds lead to transformed lives that are offered to God as living sacrifices and are seen in the world in humility, unity, and love, especially within the church body. And that's not to say that we don't have any responsibilities to those outside of the body. In fact, Paul is going to address that. Paul is not saying here that we must do these things in order to be Christians. I suppose we could take a list like this and sort of just pull it out of its context and say, oh, here's how you become a Christian. You must keep these things. Obviously, Paul is not saying that. He's saying that we must do these things because we are Christians, because we are justified by faith, because we do believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. Another way to put it is that we make known that we are Christians, Christ followers, Christ disciples. We make known that we are Christians by this kind of genuine love. And everything that Paul has given us, particularly in this paragraph, is showing us that genuine, sincere love that he began it with. Jesus said in John chapter 13, verses 34 to 35, a new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another. Not only are we commanded to do this, but we also see that this is an important, crucial aspect of our witness to the world. So we just finish off with this question to be considered. What would it be like to truly be known for this? To truly be known in this way? That is a body of genuine lovers of one another.